tonight on Arena. Reese Witherspoon stars in Little Fires Everywhere, the TV adaptation of the Celeste Ng novel, and new albums from Charlie XCX, the 1975, and Bleeding Heart Pigeons. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A new TV series based on Little Fires Everywhere, Celeste Ng's best-selling 2017 novel, stars Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington as two mothers from very different backgrounds, and it shows us how they upend each other's lives. Jen Gannon has been watching the series for us and she joins me now. It really is chalk and cheese when it comes to these two characters, to their styles of being, apart from anything else, but and their styles of parenting, which we'll get into in a little while, Jen. But give me a sense of how different Reese Witherspoon's Elena and Kerry Washington's, is it Mia is the character's name? I think it is, isn't it? Yeah. How yeah. different those characters are.
Well, Reese Witherspoon is really cornering the market in type A, highly strong, highly functional women. She's done it in Big Little Lies as well. And it's the same with this character who is a small town journalist and mother, Elena Richardson. And she is the kind of have it all woman. She walks around with ankle weights on when she's calling her children to eat in the, for their breakfast. And she has this picture perfect kitchen like Martha Stewart's. And her life completely changes when she's put into contact with this very bohemian single mother, Mia Warren, and that's who Kerry Washington plays. And Mia is an artist and a photographer, and she kind of lets her daughter Pearl roam free and is very into, you know, home schooling and togetherness like that. And there's two against one, whereas Elena is very into the traditional partnership and parental partnership and the traditional, you know, 2.4 children in a perfect house, and their lives are completely upended by coming into contact with each other.
The way they come into contact with each other is even quite interesting and gives a kind of a status to the relationship, or different statuses to the two characters within the relationship. Reese Witherspoon's character Elena is the landlord to the for the block or for the apartment where Kerry Washington's character Mia moves in.
Yeah, she allows Mia to rent a house after she discovers her and Pearl, her teenage daughter, are sleeping in their car. And it's odd circumstances because she had actually called the police about their predicament, and not because out of any heartwarming circumstances, but because she didn't want anybody else in the town to witness them being unsightly and unsavory and bringing the neighbourhood down. And that's where this real tension lies, because the series sticks to the book to the most part, but with one big difference, that Mia and her daughter Pearl, in the book their race isn't specified, but in the show they're black characters, and that adds this kind of fraught jolt of polarity between the two families, which is really where the tension kind of comes from in the show.
And the tension is there almost from the very beginning, but particularly as the I watched the first episode. I know you've seen a little bit more than that, but in that first episode, at one point in this clip that I'm about to play, Reese Witherspoon's character decides that she's going to help Kerry Washington's character with a little offer of work, and she offers it in the way only Elena could offer it.
You know, I've been meaning to hire someone for my house, just to do a little light cleaning, some laundry, maybe cook dinner.
You mean like to be your maid?
More like a housekeeper.
Yeah, I don't do that.
Oh, I wasn't assuming. You said the thing about the museum and the 3 a.m.
Yeah, because I wanted to cultivate a relationship with the curator. I got something that I needed out of it.
No, you would get something out of this as well. I mean, we would pay. We pay really well. I mean, we pay what's fair, and whatever you thought was fair, that's what we would pay. But I just, you know, what I meant was house helper, house manager. That's what I really meant, because I'm so unorganized. But it was just a suggestion, so take it or leave it. Take it or leave it.
I went to use the lawnmower and it's out of gas.
Oh, I'll send Bill over with gas.
Yeah, or Moody next time he comes over.
Wait, I'm sorry. My son Moody?
Yeah. He and Pearl have been hanging out every day. You didn't know. Okay.
There we go. Kerry Washington and Reese Witherspoon in a scene there from Little Fires Everywhere, the new Amazon Prime adaptation of the Celeste Ng novel. Jen Gannon has been watching some of the series for us. My favourite line, I think, in that clip, Jen, is when when Reese Witherspoon's character says, "I'm so unorganised." She is the most organised woman in the world. In fact, she even, maybe something we should all take on board in these lockdown times, she measures out the wine that she's going to drink into a jug and then funnels it back in. She has a specific number of millilitres that she takes. That's it. There's no moving from that. She sticks to her guns. Sex is on a Saturday. It's planned that way. Never at any other time. She's the most organised woman in the world.
There's a great scene where they're having a book club meeting, and usually, you know, a book club is, you know, in other words, a lot of wine and a lot of women shouting and talking. And she says, "I can't have any more. I had my 4 ounces of wine and that's it." And I think that's the great thing about her character. Elena moves from one self-righteous crusade blunder to another within that relationship between her and Mia. Mm-hmm. And there's these great family dinners that the Richardson family have, and they all kind of develop into these darkly comic, misguided commentary on race relations in America, because one of her daughters has a black boyfriend, and at one point the character Elena says, "Oh, I say African American because Jesse Jackson says that and he's on TV." And I think that kind of sums up her white privilege and her white guilt that, you know, Mia brings to the fore by her very presence.
But it did strike me from the first episode, now that this may change as the series goes on, but it does focus a lot on the children, and in fact focuses on the children in the way they are parented. It's focusing on the parenting of the children. That's a very important theme within this.
Yeah, I think the real substance of the story is motherhood. I think the show focuses tightly on Elena and Mia raising their daughters and how they raise their daughters and the loss of parental control that comes with adolescence and those fears and worries about where their daughters' futures are going. And, you know, they're kind of mourning the death of the simplicity of childhood and being able to control their children's lives. And that is especially what Elena is afraid of, because her young teen, Lexi, is very rebellious and she's battling with her constantly. And Lexi envies Mia and Pearl's artistic nomadic life. But then Mia and Pearl, who seem like they have a perfect relationship, their closeness curdles by the presence of Mia Elena and her family. Pearl grows, you know, wants the conformity of Elena's family because she's had a lifetime of change.
Of course, yeah, you always want what the other family has. You don't want what your own family has. Isabel Marie is how Elena always refers to that daughter that you're speaking about there. She's very artistic. She plays in the orchestra. She loves painting. She does her own type of thing, which of course attaches her to Mia, who's the artist. But let's listen to a scene where she's just put on an outfit to go and play with the orchestra. And the outfit is certainly, well, it's not to Mammy's like at all.
What are you wearing? I'm gonna button it.
No, just no. Where is the dress that I bought you last week?
Mom, just please stop. It's not me.
You lost the privilege of being you when you set your hair on fire. No one wears cut-off jeans to perform with the Cleveland Youth Chamber Orchestra.
I do.
Well, this isn't about you. That's not how the world works. There are rules, and they exist for a reason. If you follow the rules, you'll succeed.
Succeed in rule following?
Just put on the goddamn dress and brush what's left of your hair.
Oh, welcome to the teen years. And that is Isabel, the character of Izzy or Isabel, played there by Megan Stott, and Elena, played by Reese Witherspoon, in the TV adaptation of Little Fires Everywhere. Jen Gannon speaking to us about it this evening. One of the problems here is Reese Witherspoon going to play any different character apart from the uptight, white, privileged woman?
See, this is the problem and I think Reese Witherspoon herself is actually trying her best to adapt these major, you know, best-selling works like The Way with Big Little Lies, because she's invested in producing as well as starring. So I think when the best-selling novels move away from that kind of protagonist, maybe she'll get to change. But she was very different on The Morning Show. I don't know if you saw that on Apple TV with Jennifer Aniston, and she played Jennifer Aniston's co-anchor, and she was a Southern down-home southern gal who was very tough and had a lot of moxie, yeah, and who was very different from any of these characters. So, you know, the range is there. It's just trying to create those opportunities where you can have a bit of difference.
And to be fair to her, I would have to say, I think Reese Witherspoon is watchable. She's so watchable, no matter much you want to get annoyed at the character she may be playing. She's a very watchable actor.
Yeah, I think both of them, it's, you know, compelling, engrossing viewing between her and Kerry Washington as they go up against each other. Like, they sometimes have very clunky monologues, but when you're watching them, there's this uneasy tolerance between the two of them, and you're constantly waiting for the drama to ignite and for them to boil over. And it's great viewing where you're seeing them, you know, rubbing up against each other and rubbing each other the wrong way. And that's very enjoyable.
One thing that did strike me, it's set in 1997, the novel at any rate. I didn't really see that many 90s references within, certainly within episode one. Does it change as the series goes on?
No, as it goes on, I found it really heavy-handed because you have everything from Ellen coming out to Ricky Lake to MTV's The Real World and Slim Fast, they all get a mention. Yeah. Then you have a soundtrack that has Chumbawamba and the Cardigans' Love Fool. And I think the biggest 90s reference is the fact that Dawson's Creek heartthrob Pacey Witter, Joshua Jackson, he plays Elena's seemingly easygoing defence attorney husband, Bill. And I think that's the most shocking thing, to see a 90s heartthrob like Joshua Jackson playing a grown up dad character. That
in
shocked
the 90s.
Me. Yeah.
Okay. And finally, Lynn Shelton, who's the director, she sadly died away last week. In fact, she wanted the focus to be on motherhood. Do you think that's there in this series? And is it a fitting tribute to her work?
I definitely do. I think that, you know, she really worked hard to get this to the screen. You know, she did everything. She did a 99-page lookbook to pitch for the series and a two-hour monologue to producers about why she wanted to tell this particular story. And I think by the fact that she kind of parses away the book's subplots and just homes in on the story of these two mothers, and it's about mothering and it's about different types of mothers and, you know, those who deserves to be a mother is one of the questions. And, you know, the difference between being a mother from foster or adoptive birth or being a mother in the other sense. And it's all these different layers of mothering that come to the fore. And it talks about race and class and white privilege and white fragility. And I think this, you know, Little Fires Everywhere was her baby. And I think it is a fitting tribute to her. I think she'd yet to reach her artistic peak. And I would say to anyone to, you know, find her films, her indie films are great. Your Sister's Sister.
Oh, yeah. Who's the actor who's in this who was also in Your Sister's Sister? Your Sister's Sister was a great movie.
Yeah, Mark Duplass was in it, and Emily Blunt and Rosemary DeWitt.
Rosemary
DeWitt,
in
Little Fires Everywhere, is in it too. And I think it's a great film, you know, very underrated. Yeah. But I do think this show is a testament to her protective fierceness over the material and over the story that she wanted to tell. And it's, you know, basically a melodrama about mothering and motherhood.
All right. I've watched episode one. Should I keep going? How much of it have you watched? Are you dying to get back to it?
I am dying to get back to it. The minute I put, like, this call is over, I will be going back to it. So I'm on episode four now of eight, I think, or nine. So I'm really enjoying it. And it's a very good Friday evening with a bottle of wine kind of watch. So I would definitely recommend it.
All of which is perfectly acceptable, except you can't go to watch it until 8 o'clock when this programme is
over.
Thank you very much to Jen Gannon speaking to us there about Little Fires Everywhere, the TV adaptation available on Amazon Prime Video right now. 19 minutes past seven on Friday night's Arena. Physician and author Daniel Mason has published three novels, including the award-winning The Winter Soldier from 2018, a book that told the experiences of a young medical student during World War I. The intersection of history and science is once again to the fore in Mason's new short story collection, A Registry of My Passage from the Earth. But as well as that intersection, art and science, and how they play off each other, is a very important theme within several of the nine stories in the book. I'm delighted to have Daniel Mason join me this evening. Physician is such a wonderfully old word, but is it psychiatry that is actually the particular area of speciality for you, Daniel, as in your medical life?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm a clinical psychiatrist. I work at a university hospital at Stanford here in California. Trained in general medicine, but then we specialize afterwards. And I've been practicing this, I guess, for about 10 years now.
But within your professional life, within that professional medical life, arts and the expression of an artistic expression are a vital part of what you do within your clinical practice.
Right, and increasingly so. So my appointments divided up between clinical work, working in the hospital with medical students and trainees, and then also teaching a pair of classes at the university for undergraduates, specifically on the intersection of the humanities and psychiatry. So one course in, for example, the different manifestations and expressions of psychosis in literary texts across time, which has both a literary purpose and to teach the students how to look at these texts and appreciate the text, but also a clinical one as well to help teach those who may one day become doctors to better understand experiences that are so different from our own.
You know, this whole, the division of science and art, it's an old, hoary debate. In fact, it's been going on for a long, long time, I think. Given that you are a psychiatrist and you are an author, you must find the idea that the two things are totally separate quite hard to fathom, given that they both exist quite happily within you.
Well, they exist within me. I think that they struggle with each other at times because, like you mentioned, I think that there's increasing disciplinary divisions that has occurred with increasing specialization. I've found, I think one thing that's been exciting as life has gone on is to find the different ways that the two different fields end up informing each other. So whether it's reading an old case report because I'm interested in a patient and coming across a story in an old case report that then inspires a short story or a novel. So, for example, in this collection, there's a short story about a doctor who has seizures that turn him into a better version of himself. That's actually based on a real case report that was written in the 19th century. Doesn't occur quite the way I have it in my fictionalized version, but you know, there's inspiration in medical texts everywhere. There's also this wonderful poetry of medical language, which I love exploring. But then the other way too, I found is increasingly rich in how I find that what I'm reading or what I'm teaching ends up then informing my clinical practice, and that can be anywhere from looking at works of art showing visions of melancholy and you know, studying body posture and teaching that body posture to students. To reading old accounts that people have written about their own experiences, or even just thinking about a clinical encounter in the context of a story that's being told and you know, almost sort of entering the room and imagining it the way that I might imagine it as a writer, thinking, what's this patient's backstory? What are the tensions in their life? Who are the people? How have they brought them to be the person that they are today? I think that all of that comes from reading literature.
And I'll come to the specifics of the title story a little bit later, A Registry of My Passage Upon the Earth. But that word registry, very much a clinical word, a medical word in lots of ways. I'm wondering what register you were in when you came to write the opening story in the book, The Death of about the death of the pugilist, or the famous battle of Jacob Burke and Blind Man McGraw. That's actually the title, Death of the Pugilist, or the famous battle of Jacob Burke and Blind Man McGraw. I found this story fascinating, I have to say. Are they real people? Is this from a case report you found somewhere, or an historical document you found somewhere, or are they totally fictional?
So it's a mix. There's a couple of real historical characters. The hero, the protagonist, Irishman Jacob Burke, who is a bare knuckle fighter in Regency era England. He's invented. But the fights that between these men, you know, for the most part, lower class men, working class men, being brought together in these large, hastily constructed arenas, usually illegally so, on the outskirts of the cities, you know, and engaging in these intensely bloody battles of dozens of rounds. That was true, and also for the story, what was true, and I think the reason that inspired me to write it is I'd come across some images of these men, and this had led me then to reading some of the old boxing accounts, and I encountered this exquisite English that was on one hand both my language but also totally unfamiliar to me. Just a vocabulary, a cant, a rhyming slang that was sort of spoken by people once that I could recognize but not quite. And And it felt like almost like, you know, I wonder if it's what a musician feels like when they stumble across like an old instrument that they can kind of figure out how to play, but it's something that's totally different. And so it was working in that register, like you mentioned, that was so much fun in writing this story.
In fact, it struck me that across the 9 stories of the book, you shift register almost from story to story. It's as if each story has a particular language that it needs to have for it to be told. I mean, I'm thinking in particular in this one, and you'll have to correct my pronunciation, the miraculous discovery of, is he Sam Ethicus the first? Do we leave out the P at the top?
I think it's Semeticus, the Semeticus for, the first.
Semeticus, right. You
know, old Egyptian pharaoh is not around to correct our pronunciation, so I think okay.
We'll go with Semeticus then, you and I. Again, a fascinating character, and what he wanted to find out about language and the origins of language. Give us a sense of who, again, I'm presuming an historical character, but perhaps an invention of yours?
No, so this was a historical character who ended up surprising me in the way he appeared in history and other places, actually sort of reaffirmed the story as I was writing it. He's an Egyptian pharaoh, sort of famous because he's mentioned in Herodotus for this experiment in which he wanted to find out what the oldest language in the world was, sort of the proto-language of mankind. Mm-hmm. And so he decided that he wasn't just going to take anyone's advice for it, but he was going to carry out an experiment. And so as the story goes, he takes 2 children, babies newly born, and then gives them to a goat herd to raise among his goats, with the idea that they're not going to hear any sort of human speech and so be prejudiced to speak a particular language. And then they grow up and eventually they speak their first word, and the word is Bekos. And he gets this translated, and it turns out to be the language Phrygian, and so therefore declares that he understands that the oldest language in the world is Phrygian. And you know, of course, this is just a sort of ridiculous story. Yeah. But at the same time, in thinking about him, I was drawn to him because, you know, as a psychiatrist, I hear about behavioral studies all the time, some of which are I wouldn't say as bad as Semeticus's study, but getting there.
Yeah.
And so it was a chance to sort of look at that kind of science, but also it had me wonder, like, how fascinating that this ancient pharaoh has this kind of intellectual curiosity that would lead him to do this. And so the story's a riff on that. It's sort of exploring the other experiments that Semeticus carried out.
And the linguistic register that you use here is a sort of a biblical feel to it, certainly to my reading.
Yeah, so it's based on a 19th century English translation of Herodotus, which so you have sort of the translation, the original Greek kind of mixed in a way, right? There's this, it has, I think, this the repetition of the and, which is sort of King Jamesian biblical in origin.
I come then to the title story of the collection, A Registry of My Passage Upon the Earth. And this struck me, well, when you choose one of the stories to give to the title of the collection, it seems to say that story says something to you, the author, about the overall themes that you're discovering or that you're exploring here. Am I right in thinking that? And what does it say to you?
Yeah, no, I think you're very, very much right in thinking that. So this was actually the first story that I wrote. So before I realized, I think I realized probably around the third or fourth story that this was going to be a collection all about people in as different places as possible, all going through a similar kind of crisis or epiphany. But this was before that, and what had happened, I was working on my second book which was set in Brazil at the time, and I had come across in this very dusty little town this image of this painting of this, sorry, photograph of this man in this extraordinary coat of his own creation, who actually kind of reminded me of a patient that I had had back in San Francisco, a man who used to adorn himself with traffic signs. And I asked who he was, and the local villager said that he was the most famous person from their town. And when I looked into it further, I learned that he had spent most of his life at an insane asylum outside Rio de Janeiro. His name's Arthur Bispo. I encourage any listener to immediately go and Google image his work, because then as I began to learn about him, I discovered this extraordinary artist who, despite the incredible adversity that he faced, would de-thread his hospital clothing, for example, and then embroider onto the hospital sheets. So most of his works are blue thread embroidered onto these big white sheets. doing this because he heard voices that informed him that he was on this divine mission to make a registry of the world to be presented to God for Judgment Day, because according to this mythology, God wouldn't know what it was like on Earth, and it was Arthur Bispo's job to tell him. And so the story itself is a registry of the things that Bispo sees, from the very mundane buttons that he finds on the street to, you know, more sublime concepts like female beauty, for instance. He has some works about that. And this just seemed to me then, and then increasingly so as time has gone on, as this just wonderful expression of what the creative process is like for many of us. You know, it's an attempt to somehow capture this world that we're going through and put it on paper and retain it somehow during this very fleeting time.
One story I'd like to finish up with, the Lion Age and Pascal, for a couple of reasons, not least of which is Pascal, he's a telegraph operator stationed in a remote part of the Amazon, and he develops an intimate knowledge of his distant colleagues. So we can be as socially distant, as physically distant as we like in Pascal's world, but yet we can still have that. We can still have intimacy of some kind. You really are. You probably wrote this long before isolation and self-isolation and COVID-19 was anywhere near you. Do you think that Pascal maybe is a good role model for us in terms of being intimate at a distance?
Maybe. I hope so. I think one of the most difficult thing for a human being to do is to be alone in a room. That's why I call him Pascal. It's sort of a riff on Blaise Pascal's famous line about the most difficulty for man being alone in a room. And yet he forms these relationships. And you know, he puzzled me. People like him puzzled me, because there were people like him who could live in such total isolation and yet build from in his case, just the sort of tapping of the telegraph key, build these relationships, these fights, tensions, fantasies about the people that really rich internal life or shared life with people that they weren't in contact with, and so he's an imagining like that. But no, of all the stories, I think he is one of the ones that I think about, probably the one I think about the most during these periods of time, because you know it's quite hard to be isolated and to not know when one is going to return to one's friends, one's family, sort of the common human experience, and then just to think about the other ways of being a person in a social world during this time is, I think, a challenge that everybody's facing.
Yeah, but I suppose you probably, and you can't say you'll send us directly to your books, but you possibly would. But I think for you, reading is one of the greatest ways of maintaining mental health. And I suppose in these times when we are alone, reading is not a bad way to have lots of people with you.
No, I think that reading, I mean, there are studies that show that reading is associated with various positive mental health outcomes. I think on a personal, sort of anecdotal level, that I notice a marked difference in my mood over the course of a day if I'm reading something good at that time. It's like I know that evening when it's quiet again, I'll be able to return to this rich, imaginative world. And there's something about not being given images that allows us to create, and there's something about, I think, that creative process that occurs while reading that prompts a sort of engagement with the text and its characters, but also something as fundamental as language that can make, you know, even being in a little room, as hard as it is, a richer experience.
Well, thanks for speaking to us about your book this evening. In fact, which has some images throughout it, but we leave that to the reader to find out as he or she goes through those beautiful little drawings, which kind of link in with the scientific theme, I think, in some ways. That's Daniel Mason there speaking to me about his collection of short stories, A Registry of My Passage Upon the Earth. It's published by Mantle. And so on to the final lap of the week and the final half hour of Friday's programme, Album Reviews. First up will be Charlotte Aitchison. I meant to check her name, surname pronunciation, from Cambridge in England, professionally known as Charlie XCX. Comes with her fourth album, written and recorded entirely in lockdown. It's entitled How I'm Feeling Now. Limerick trio Bleeding Heart Pigeons released their first album since parting ways with their major label partners. It's out today and it's called Stir. And finally, the 1975, something of a Marmite band from Manchester in England with album number 4 with the curious title Notes on a Conditional Form. Zara Hederman and Gavin Glass have been listening. We're going to start with Charlie XCX. The album is called How I'm Feeling Now. Here is a track called Detonate.
I don't trust myself at all. Why should you trust me? I don't trust myself alone. Why should you love me?
Detonate, the title of that track from Charlie XCX and her new album, How I'm Feeling Now. Zara Hederman and Gavin Glass, as I said, are our reviewers this evening. Tell me a little bit more about Charlotte Aitchison, if that's how I say her name correctly, Zara.
Yeah, that is. You've got it spot on, Sean. So Charlotte Aitchison, Charlie XCX, she is a Cambridge-born singer, songwriter, producer and music video director. She, from a very early age, showed her aptitude for crafting an earworm, like we heard there with Detonate. When she was 14, she actually asked her parents for a loan so that she could record her first album. While that didn't get commercially released, she has since then gone on to write numerous songs for huge stars such as Iggy Azalea, Shawn Mendes and Camila Cabello. She's got a great collaborative nature to her music, which we saw on her previous album, Charlie, which only came out in September 2019. On that alone, it had names like Christine and the Queens, Lizzo, Sky Fiera. So what we have with Charlie XCX is someone who is, I think, anyway, one of the most prominent and prolific pop voices.
Yeah, and indeed, as you say, you know, Christine and the Queens, Sky Fiorella, and lots of others, Lizzo on here as well. Lots of people, lots of collaborations, in fact. But Gavin, the first line of your note says, 28-year-old British-born LA-based electro-pop nails lockdown. Now, hold on a little minute. She did this in 6 weeks, recorded it, she says, wrote it, recorded it, and got all of these collaborators somehow to record their bits socially distant, I'm presuming and hoping. Is that a bit of an old spin? I'll use the lockdown as a way to sell my album.
As a 43-year-old grumpy man at this stage, I'm going to say, goddamn millennials. They're all coming out fluent in Japanese, able to make sourdough. And yeah, I don't know. I'm a producer and I think I've gotten about 8 bars of a song since lockdown. I'm like creative wasteland. So I'm trying to wrap my head around her ability to, you know, collaborate online through Twitter and her social media and say, any beat makers out there want to throw some beats across and to have the she's so brave and the audacity to go, here's the first line of a song. Anybody want to help me out and to open the kind of creative windows and let, you know, people in like that? I'm just in awe of it. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, she seems, Zara, to be able to write a hook or maybe, as Gavin says, get a hook from somebody else and then just run with it and make these, you know, two and a half, three-minute songs, all of them very radio-friendly. But is there much substance behind the sheen of all of that?
I have to say that for a quarantine album, I think she, as Gavin said in his notes, nails it by, in lyrical terms, I mean, her themes are rooted and reflective of life in isolation. So we have, you know, being the mundanities of being bored in her house, wanting to go and party with her friends, and then also kind of looking a bit more microscopically at her 7-year-long relationship. So she does that. I mean, there are some lines where it is just quite basic. There's some where it's I like you a lot repeated to a mantra, and you can really see how that is where she's kind of throwing the paint at the canvas. But in terms then of, you know, the substance musically and tonally, I think that she also managed manages to capture that feeling of isolation, especially on the first track, Pink Diamond, which is this really claustrophobic and such a compact arrangement that you feel like there's no escape from it. And then later on the album, we have these like Euro trance and EDM numbers that again kind of get your heart racing, but in a kind of anxious way. So I think in a broader term, she does, there is substance here. Now, while sometimes the lyrics aren't, you know, the best at times, she has done very well in a 6 week period.
What were you going to say there, Gavin, at the top?
No, I mean, I just exactly what Zara said. I'm echoing totally that.
Yeah, so you agree that she had, there is substance here as well. Well, let's listen to one of the tracks here called Anthems, which refers specifically to where we all find ourselves right now. There we go. Anthems from Charlie XCX and her new album, How I'm Feeling Now. So, Gavin, overall, you're in awe of this millennial and what she can do in 6 weeks in lockdown.
I am. Look, it's not something I would reach for. The overly auto-tuned vocals and the beefy basses and glitchy synths are something that I would usually reach for. Mm. But that tune you played in particular, Anthems, like, it's a millennial thing that we're going to go to the 1975 later, but all I could hear was Basement Jack's Where's Your Head At from the melodic line and that. Mm. And whether it's, I haven't seen the liner notes, so I don't know whether it's credited, but I just find that thing of just borrowing so much that's been there already so prevalent in this kind of pop music, but it's well executed and she knocked it out. I'm super impressed.
Stars from you, Gavin, first of all.
3.5.
3.5 from you. What are you saying overall, Sarah, and stars?
Overall, like, while there was some moments in the songs where I wasn't so invested in, kind of like Anthems, she did manage to get that hook ingrained in my head. And I think that that is such a, you know, a skill and just a show of how great she is at pop music. So I'm going to go 3.5 as well.
All right. OK, so good, fairly solid scores from both of you there. Let's move on to Bleeding Heart Pigeons. A lovely title for a band trio from Limerick. Their first album since parting ways with a major record company, Universal, in fact. Gavin, how big a deal is that when a band breaks from a huge label and they kind of have to prove themselves all over again, or is it a monkey lifted off your back, or what do you think of that kind of move first of all?
Sean, if you think of a band getting a record deal as to a major, it's like one in a million. Mm. And then when your dreams and your hopes get crushed from the machine, it's very hard for any band to pick themselves up from that. And I think what the lads have done is just, yeah, they knocked it out of the park.
All right, so it worked for you. Tell me who we're talking, a cosy converted farm shirt is where all of this happens, Sarah. Who are we talking about when we talk about Bleeding Heart Pigeons?
Yeah, so Bleeding Heart Pigeons, as we said, they are from Limerick. They're a synth pop trio. And of course, Limerick in the last couple of years has really become such a wealth of talent, particularly in the alternative and independent scene. Bleeding Heart Pigeons, they started out in 2013 with their EP In a Room in Littleton, Colorado. And kind of with each release then, their sound got bigger, more synths were coming in. They were kind of brandish then, of course, with Radiohead comparisons, which, you know, you do get from time to time in terms of, say, some of the guitar riffs employed throughout. Here we have a really self-sufficient band in that we have Micheál Keating, who is the vocalist, who is on production duties for this album. And as you mentioned, the cozy farm shed, one of the band members kind of said how that space really lent to the overall sound and the production by giving a lovely natural reverb to it.
Well, let's have a listen to one of the tracks and see if we can pick up the sound of the cow shed or the farm shed. No. It mightn't be a cow shed. Let's not be sheddist on this one. All for the best. All for the best from Bleeding Horse Pigeons and their new album, Stir. And Gavin Glass, yeah, you'd go a long way to find a studio that would give you a sound like that. Farm Shed is an incredible sound, isn't it?
It is. And you know something, I can just imagine that how that studio felt. Like, you can hear it on the synthesizers. They're as icy as a cold December morning. It's beautiful. Mm. And the drums have a really crisp, dry sound. It's I'm totally in that studio listening to this record. Like, the singer Michal did all the production on that, and he's actually building up a really good roster himself. As Zara touched on, some of the independent band out of Limerick, he's behind a lot of their records as well. But Zara, yeah, he knocks the production. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, you were just going to say he knocks it out of the park, I think, because you enjoyed it. But Zara mentioned the specifics there of Radiohead and comparisons to Radiohead. You mentioned that yourself, and you also brought in Depeche Mode. Is that a problem, or did they manage to take those influences on board? Because, I mean, let's face it, everybody's going to be influenced by somebody. To take the influence on board and then move beyond it. Have they managed to do that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I mentioned Depeche Mode, I get that kind of... It's hard to make music that's kind of quantized and super on the grid and from a production point of view and make it emotive. And I think Depeche Mode were masters of that. And that's what I get from this record, is that they've managed to, you know, mix groove, synths, and kind of... A very kind of linear approach to the rhythm. It just really works for me.
Right, let's have a listen to a little bit of the title track, Stir. And that's the title track there, Stir, from the new album from Bleeding Heart Pigeons. And Zara, I mean, I've written this down at several points along when I was listening to this album. That's a big arrangement. It's almost orchestral at times. It sounds as if they're, you know, there's a whole band, a whole raft of musicians behind them, not just whatever it is. Did you say it's a trio, isn't it? Yeah?
It is, yeah, it's a trio.
So these are big.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
They are big, and with that song in particular, when I listened to it first, what really stood out to me is, I mean, this is very synth driven, and I think a lot of the time listeners could kind of associate synths with quite bright arpeggios and shimmery notes. This is really sinister, and it's very spooky, to the point where it really creates this very immersive world, and one that I was really happy to get lost in, because there's parts of this song in particular that reminded me of, say, the sound design across David Lynch's films and TV shows. And I just really was captivated by this. And you might laugh at me, but when I was listening to it the other night on headphones, I actually got quite scared at night listening to it, and I had to turn it off and switch to kind of Good Dogs Don't Die, which is a lot brighter. And, you know, it's a soothing arrangement or song more so. Yeah. But they master all of the arrangements that they do on this, and it's just so impressive.
Yeah, keep the light on in the bedroom now when you're listening in future, Zara.
Oh, Sean, every night.
No, tell me, stars first. Stars from you, Zara, first of all.
I thought this was excellent, and I'm really looking forward to see these songs live. So for me, it's a 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from you. And you were echoing and agreeing with a lot of what Zara was saying there, Gavin, in terms of those big arrangements.
Evocative, gloomy and sexy. What more could you ask for?
Well, number of stars would be what I'd be looking
for. Totally agree on the David Lynch, though. I totally got David Lynch vibrations off.
Stars from you, Gavin?
4.
4 from you as well. Yeah, you can see that in a David Lynch TV or film, can't you? Really can. Okay, let's move on to the 1975. Let's have a listen to something first. This is Jesus Christ 2005, God Bless America.
Searching for planes in the sea, and that's irony. Soil just needs water to be.
All right, I better get bring them down so that we can get a few opinions from our reviewers this evening. The 1975, they're the veterans really of our three artists tonight, formed in Manchester in 2002. Gavin, I said beforehand that these were a Marmite band. You want to like the Marmite if you're going to eat 22 tracks of it?
I wouldn't watch them if they were playing out the back garden and pull the curtains.
You didn't enjoy the 22 tracks, did you not?
Sean, this is the first time I felt claustrophobic in lockdown, was having to listen to the 80 minutes and 22 songs of borrowed ideas, half-baked. I hated it. I was in bad form for the day after listening to the record.
Zara, I don't think I'm going to get anything different from you. Let's ask about the opening track, which is called, I think, the 1975, isn't it?
Oh,
as well.
It is.
With Greta Thunberg giving us...
Allow myself to introduce myself.
What did you think, Sarah? Did you buy it?
Not at all, Sean. And I wish we had a lot more time to talk about this album. But basically, yes, so they had a whole host of guests. Greta Thunberg, we've got Twigs, FKA Twigs, we've got Phoebe Bridgers. This is just an absolute vanity project for the frontman, Matty Healy. This band are so lacking in any kind of substance. And as you said, Marmite, that reference is even outdated for them because he has said himself, I'm not an avocado, not everyone thinks I'm amazing. This is, they're just a truly inconsequential band.
Well, let me just
opinion.
Ask you one thing though. If we had less than 22 songs, could they have edited it this down into a record? Because I enjoyed some of the tracks, I have to say. Could we have edited it down into a record that we'd enjoy?
It should have been edited down massively to the point of could we have enjoyed it? I don't know, Sean, because there's just such little vacuousness to these arrangements.
Okay.
Lyrically as well, there's nothing to be taken from it. I think if you're to enjoy it, pick out the bits that they've robbed and just go and listen to the source. That's what I would do. Yeah.
Stars, Zara.
Right on.
If I can give less than one, I would. Otherwise, it's a one.
Well, you can give none if you want. And
I'll give it none then.
No, okay. And finally and quickly from you, Gavin.
As Zara said, I'll go down the minus figures. It's okay. They ruined my day.
All right. Sorry for wrecking the day on you. That's Gavin Glass and Zara Hedeman, who clearly will not be listening to Notes on a Conditional Form again from the 1975, but they may well be listening to both Stir from Bleeding Heart Pigeons and How I'm Feeling Now from Charlie XCX. That's our lot for this evening, indeed, for this week. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. In fact, I think it was Leah just today. Paula's on a day off, if I'm not right. So Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Mark Dwyer. And tonight's programme was produced by Damien O'Mara. Have a great weekend. Talk to you on Monday at 7.